Okay, we're going to take a holistic approach to this. We're going to design the necessary hardware, the necessary software, and from a clean sheet, how should and can an airplane or helicopter be flown today with the most advanced hardware and software technology that's available? And if it's fully integrated, how can we bring the highest level of safety-enhancing technology to pilots and their passengers? And that's really what we did.
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host John Ramstad takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
Today's episode is brought to you by our platinum sponsor, XTI Aerospace. They are powering the vertical economy, building a long-range VTOL, and you can find more at xtiaerospace.com. Now, please remember to like, comment, and share on this channel, and enjoy today's podcast. Welcome to Hangar X Studios, and this is where innovators and creators and investors and people that are leading our industry with this aerospace revolution that's happening right now, especially around vertical and advanced air mobility, come to get the latest information to make decisions that we all need to hear about. And please subscribe and like to this channel. Share it with a friend. We're going to have an incredible conversation today. We have Mark Grodin on from Skyrise. Mark, first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, John. Happy to be here.
Well, you know, Skyrise, I've been following you guys for a long time, and you are defining what safe flight is. And this is part of the vision that you even started the company around with both autonomy and automation and flight controls. And you're doing something that, as a private pilot myself, military pilot, commercial, you've been able to put this in SR-22s and Robinsons and now a Black Hawk. We're going to be talking about this. But this really is, a foundational technology that is going to be needed for where aerospace is going, to achieve the vision that a lot of us have in the space. Do you think that's a fair statement, Mark?
I do. And I think it's a front that hasn't been advanced meaningfully in decades, and is probably one that is most needed. And to your point about safety, the reason why I got into this is because I was really passionate about becoming a pilot as a kid, started learning how to fly. Tragically, my instructor was killed in an accident at a low altitude stall. His daughter and his granddaughter were on board. Very tragic. And then from that point, I started looking at the statistics in general aviation and more broadly, all of aviation. And what quickly jumps off the page is that, you know, things like loss of control in flight and controlled flight into terrain, these things that are preventable with advanced automation and in many ways have already been solved in Part 25 airliners, that automation technology hasn't made its way outside of very small parts of the market. And so I founded the company to make that a reality because I believe that is the barrier to unlocking what a lot of people would consider advanced air mobility. And recently, you know, the national strategy was published in the last month or so on what advanced air mobility looks like. And we were really proud to see that one of the pillars written into that report was all about automation and even focused on simplified vehicle operation and included a picture of one of our cockpits, the SR-22. So I don't think we're alone in that view. Obviously, you know, many folks are aligned there and believe that if you can increase the safety of aviation, a lot more people will engage in aviation. And that doesn't just mean it's safer and easier to fly. That means we're going to redefine what this transportation modality looks like and how it integrates into the fabric of our lives.
Yeah, when I was in the military, Mark, went to a number of funerals. And I would say, I mean, this is a very high-speed, dynamic environment, but almost all of them were pilot air, right? Controlled flight or in what you're talking, and you know, it's interesting. I actually met a friend recently. I said, "Hey, I'll, you know, let's go fly somewhere for lunch." You know, the $100 hamburger in the SR-22, and you know what? They were afraid of flying in small planes. I said, "Well, it's got a parachute. Well, you know, if I have a heart attack, you just pull it." That didn't help them, but there's this perception, and if you actually look at the safety record, it's incredibly safe. But what you're talking about is making flying as safe as riding an elevator, right? Is that a stretch too far?
I don't think it is. I think it's you got to put the goal on the wall if you want to get anywhere close to it. And if the aspiration is anything less, then obviously you're never going to get to something that's meaningful. And we say the elevator because the elevator is the safest place to be on a per trip basis. And then commercial airliners aren't that far behind. And obviously, if you cut the statistics on a seat mile basis, they're the best place to be in the world. We can certainly get there with advanced automation. And, you know, on the parachute point, obviously the parachute is a great piece of technology or product. But the reality is, you know, the reaction that your friend or colleague had is not irrational. If you go to the airport, you go to LAX or any major airliner, and the captain gets on the system, the speaker system, and says, not to worry, if things go wrong, we're going to punch this giant red handle and pull on it, and now it's going to come a parachute, it's going to destroy the airframe in the process. We're going to have no control of where we land, and from that point we pray, but don't worry, you know, if things go wrong, that's what we're going to do. I mean, think about how barbaric that really is in principle. It is crazy that is the best piece of safety technology that we have. It's really kind of a forfeit of all of our control and agency as a pilot and the people on board. But that's what we resort to. And we resort to that because there are not advanced, redundant automation systems on board these machines to help make it so that anybody can grab the steering wheel and, you know, metaphorically pull to the side of the road or, you know, push on the brake and slow the car down, which is why you don't have a, you know, emergency stop button inside of an automobile. It's not needed. The user interface is so simple. Anyone can engage with the vehicle and drive towards a safer outcome. So I believe that with advanced automation, if you look at that list of things that are killing people in aviation, yes, a lot of people would ascribe it to pilot error, and yes, it is true, pilots make mistakes, but it's not the responsibility of the pilot in our eyes to be perfect in all situations. In fact, I think it's inhuman what we ask pilots to do in these aircraft, especially in the context of unfolding emergencies. I mean, think about how automation today engages with pilots. You know, you have automation that works some of the time, for example, in autopilot, and then when things start to not go so well on board the machine, what happens? The automation, of course, lets go, dumps the machine on the pilot. The pilot's going through a checklist, trying to become aware of what the state of the aircraft is, and then, of course, has to recover it because it's in some type of odd attitude. And in that moment, they have to be a Chuck Yeager of pilots. They've probably never, you know, done anything like that. And they become the backup for a failed automation system. So we just believe that's backwards. And we think that if you can introduce advanced automation, you can take off the table the top 10 things that are killing people today and make them safer, more capable pilots.
Well, yeah, you know, it makes me think, Mark, I'd love to hear about your vision. Why you decided that this is the problem that you wanted to dedicate your life to solve. You have a PhD, you have 60 patents. I could go through your bio, but you're brilliant. I'd love to buy you a beer one of these days and meet you in person. But, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, I fly two or three times a month. But, you know, the other day I was coming back in here, very crowded airspace, bad weather, IMC. And even though I have the Garmin G1000, but even all the switchology and the buttons and doing everything and flying the airplane and being on the comms, you are task saturated. And that is a challenge. Especially if I'm actually trying to use the airplane for something more than just a sightseeing flight.
Exactly. And you hit the nail on the head as to why I chose to do this. I started learning how to fly. I saw that set of statistics. And, of course, as a you know, budding engineer who is really passionate about transportation, it did not make sense to me that the technology existed to do better, but it had not been integrated or materially advanced the safety of this industry. And, you know, since I founded the company, it's not if, it's when you lose someone in the course of being in aviation, to your point. And I see this as a quiet crisis. And that's how we look at this as a team, right? Is every week that goes by that this technology is not out in the market, more lives are being lost unnecessarily. And so we are incredibly motivated to bring the safety enhancing technology to the people that need it most. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are flying not just for the $100 hamburger, which is, you know, necessary for proficiency and certainly we believe in. But there are people that are waking up every morning like Air Methods we were talking about, and their mission is to save lives, right? And so on someone's worst day, you know, and they're on the side of the road and their only option is to be airlifted out of there, you know, these pilots, these crews are being forced to make really tough choices right now because they don't have advanced automation or safety enhancing technology on board these aircraft. And, you know, these are inherently unstable helicopters that fly the same way as they've flown since Igor Sikorsky, both hands, both feet, fully engaged, cyclic collective pedals. It is like riding a unicycle and juggling simultaneously, you know, just to keep the aircraft in the sky.
Well, and as you know, you can't take, it's not like an airplane. You can't take your hands off the control. And if I'm distracted, if I'm in, like, I can't even go up. It's hard to even step, get something on the panel, change a frequency. Takes a lot of core. It is a very challenging environment. I just got my rating. I know you have yours. And that is a completely different cockpit than an airplane.
100%. And so you have all the systems complexity, and then you have this, you have to be managing the stability of the platform in real time. It is the only machine we know of that is actively trying to kill you, right? Any other vehicle, if you let go of the controls, it's not going to immediately roll itself out of control and exit a flight envelope, you know, and so on and so forth. Certainly no automobile will do that to you. So, you know, I became just really, really passionate about applying technology to solve this problem. And your point about the systems complexity in the cockpit is another big part of what I think this industry currently has backwards, right? So if you look at a cockpit today in the most advanced general aviation airplane and even those that are flying professionally for like EMS, emergency medical operations, and you compare that cockpit to one that existed decades ago, has the complexity gone up or gone down? It's actually gone up. So we've just added things to the cockpit for the pilot to manage and be the intermediary, right? So all these systems, these autopilots that have these different modes, these are all things that the pilot has to manage in addition to all the primary flight controls and the communications, which have not changed or improved, you know, for decades. And so it's just been more and more and more on the lap of the pilot without a truly integrated solution supporting them. And again, we just don't think that that is a prudent way to do this. There's a lot of reasons why that's been the case, but no one has taken the time to say, okay, we're going to take a holistic approach to this. We're going to design the necessary hardware, the necessary software, and from a clean sheet, how should and can an airplane or helicopter be flown today with the most advanced hardware and software technology that's available? And if it's fully integrated, how can we bring the highest level of safety enhancing technology to pilots and their passengers? And that's really what we did. And when I started the company, we thought that we could do something that was far smaller in scope than what we ultimately arrived at, because ultimately what we found was you can't have something like a degraded mode. So for example, in a conventional fly-by-wire airplane, you know, like an Airbus or a 737 MAX, 737 MAX, great example, by the way, how many modes of operation does that fly-by-wire system have? And that obviously was one of the contributors to the accidents that recently happened. That doesn't make sense to us either, because if you're trying to make the airplane or helicopter safer, you don't want to distribute the pilot training across 12 different modes of operation. And by the way, the pilot has to discern, you know, which mode they're in real time. So it meant that we ultimately had to basically own everything with the exception of the engine. So if you look in our first aircraft, which is the Robinson R66, besides the Rolls-Royce engine, which is still the same power plant, every other system on board the aircraft is a part of our bill of material and is controlled by our central operating system, which we call SkyOS. That was necessary to get to one mode of operation and a consistent user interface in the cockpit with one control stick and two touchscreens. And we had to do that so that things like, for example, you know, an auto rotation, which is an incredibly hard maneuver for a pilot to accomplish in a helicopter, that's when the engine is lost.
Kind of fun.
Yeah, it's thrilling.
Dropping down at the ground and like time this just perfectly so I can, you know, do a full stop. But I digress.
No, exactly. I mean, it's thrilling if you're excited about that. But you know, most pilots that we talk, even you know, former 160th members, they say every auto rotation they do, their heartbeat goes up. You know, even if it's just a practice auto rotation where they roll on power. And so the idea of something like an auto rotation requiring the conventional set of controls, you know, to still be there, because if the system was not to be capable of doing it for something as complicated as an auto rotation, then you would need the conventional set of controls in addition to the user interface that we came up with. And obviously, from our point of view, that's unacceptable. And so we had to go solve for things like auto rotation, which really push a flight controls technology like this to the limit, We ultimately did, but it did mean, back to my earlier point, that we had to really take on a tremendous amount of scope.
So, you know, let's pause there for a sec. So think about this. Anybody, if you're not familiar with helicopters, you're up there, you're going to practice, you're set up, and you drop the power, which means you totally change the torque. So you got to put in the pedal, and you got to pull back in the cyclic, and you got to stabilize at a certain airspeed. So that you have, and then you're watching your rotor RPM and your airspeed. It has to be very precise all the way down, and you have to adjust to get to the right landing. And then about 40 feet off the deck, you're starting to then pull in power, which also creates torque, right? Because you're converting the power. Now there, and then you got to put it down and set it on the ground. So you are on every one of those controls: the anti-torque pedals, the cyclic, and the collective, all the way down. Without those there, how did you and your team think about this with SkyOS solving that problem?
That was one of the biggest technical feats that we've accomplished, to your point. Well, the first key point is we said, number one, the pilot agency must remain intact. And in fact, we want to increase the pilot's ability to be in control of the outcome of this situation, which are big statements and is actually the hardest way to go about building advanced automation, because at the other side of that spectrum could have been, if you've lost the engine, you know, hands off, SkyOS is in control, it's going to choose your landing site and land the aircraft without any further judgment being passed by the pilot. I don't believe in the latter. We don't believe in the latter because we think the pilot's an intelligent human, and obviously their discretion and decision making should be integrated into the system and should be integrated in real time. That real time integration of their decision, though, is the hardest because basically from the operating system's point of view, we had to be able to give the pilot the ability in real time to say, I want to change my direction, I want to land here, I want to land there, I want to start flare at this point, I want to cushion my landing wherever you want to at whatever split second. And all of those inputs are seen as random variables, right, to the operating system. The operating system has no way to demonstrably predict what it is you're going to ask of it. But we wanted to make it so that the pilot would have access to the full, now redefined flight envelope. So obviously you can't climb, you're only going to descend because you no longer have engine power. But the pilot can use the control stick to access all of the envelope that's available. So if you want to do turns, or you want to do even what's called 180 degree auto, where you turn and land in the opposite direction, you absolutely can do that with the control stick. And the system is going to manage your rotor RPM, for example, to your point. Some of the more advanced pilots, and very few will ever get to this place, but you can reduce your rotor RPM to increase your glide slope.
Correct.
And land a little further away. Mm-hmm. And so we address that too. So the system will maintain your engine RPM automatically at 100%, which is 100%. But if you want to reduce your rotor RPM all the way down to the minimum, below which you would stall the rotor RPM, that's your prerogative. You can actually do that in real time through the control stick in the auto rotation, which, you know, a conventional pilot would almost never venture, to try to do that in an aircraft unless they're incredibly practiced and probably on a test pilot level of capability, because it's so harrowing. And the idea of reducing your rotor RPM to try to increase your glide slope is just so challenging. But that's available to you.
Plus the horn's going off the whole time, and it's really annoying.
Yeah. And you know, the pilot's operating handbook for this maneuver is pretty crazy because it tells you to try to restart the engine. If available, it says, try to restart the engine. Well, to your point, both hands and feet are on the controls. So which one is going to let go of the control that's keeping the rotor RPM in check and inside the safe range and go and try and do all the things to restart the engine? That just doesn't happen. Not for most people. And so what we did is we said, okay, we're just going to immediately enter the auto rotation automatically for the pilot. So if you have a loss of power and you can't maintain the rotor RPM, you're automatically going to be in the auto rotation. You have full agency for the full envelope with the control stick. And then it is your decision when and how much you want to flare. So if you're doing, you want to do a zero velocity landing, you can pull all the way back on the stick, flare all the way to the point of no forward velocity any longer, and then set down the aircraft. And you're also controlling, obviously, your rate of descent through that and then at the end of the flare. And what that allows the pilot to do effectively at a high level is choose their landing site, which is really key, right? So that is entirely the pilot's prerogative. And all that to say, right, the pilot is more firmly in control in our eyes, because now you're not worried about keeping the rotor RPM in safe range. That's not front of mind. If you want to do an in-air restart, that's literally a touch button on our displays, and so that's easily available to you. And now your eyes are out and you're really focused on where do I want to set this aircraft down and with how much forward velocity.
So, you know, you talked about SkyOS, and this is really to create this universal operating system. And I know you wanted to, we've been talking about helicopters, but you also wanted this to work across rotor wing and fixed wing. Can you talk about just kind of the first principles that went into designing SkyOS and what it is for somebody that's maybe not familiar with it? I think they're starting to get a sense of it from what you talked about.
So the scope of SkyOS is both hardware and software. What we have had to create is everything from the actuators that replace the mechanical linkages or cables and pulleys on an airplane. So these are the devices that articulate the flight control surfaces. We have triply redundant electromechanical actuators, which are the world's first. We had to design and engineer them in-house because they didn't exist on the market. We have flight control computers, which you can actually see over my shoulder. So conventionally, an Airbus or Boeing or a fighter jet, you have literally a room of boxes that is powering the fly-by-wire system on those aircraft. Too big, too heavy, too costly to bring into an aircraft like a Sirius or, you know, a Robinson. And so therefore, similar story, we had to find a way to miniaturize that technology, make it about the size of a toaster, mm-hmm. but bring all of the reliability and redundancy that you would expect on a commercial airliner. Then we have control stick, four-axis control stick, which is also behind me, same story. And then two touchscreens inside the cockpit. In addition to that, all the sensors that you would expect needed. So everything from pedos, redundancy there, air data systems. In the case of the Robinson, it doesn't even have a digital engine control, a FADEC, so we had to incorporate that into our system. And that bill of material from a hardware standpoint is exactly the same irrespective of the airplane or the helicopter. And the reason why we're able to achieve that is because the human muscle is the same in every cockpit. So at the end of the day, whether you're flying a Sirius or Robinson or even a Blackhawk, the human muscle, its speed, its strength, and its control loop bandwidth, as we would say, is the same, irrespective of the aircraft. So if you can build an actuator that's stronger and faster than the human, then you can replace that chain of human muscle that is conventionally just mechanically linked to the flight control surface. And then from there, obviously, the hardware is the same up into the cockpit. The operating system is 1.2 million lines of code. It runs on the flight control computers. And that is really the brains of the system. Syndicates all of the sensor data input that we're getting from the vehicle, all the different systems that it's managing, and then, of course, you know, the pilot's real-time decision-making. And then inside the cockpit, your two touchscreens, think of it like a PFD, a primary flight display. So that looks relatively conventional. And then the multifunction flight display goes leaps and bounds beyond what a conventional MFD would do because you can literally control everything on the aircraft from that. And we automate that in some respects, but again, still park the pilot firmly in control of the aircraft. So that's our hardware software solution. It's taken us about a decade to design and engineer that, largely because those components, those hardware components I mentioned, did not exist off the shelf. So we had to design and engineer them from scratch. And then, of course, architect this operating system to control the machine. And what has been the challenge there and taken a lot of time is to capture the expertise of the industry and effectively encode it into an operating system takes time. So what I just walked through on how our system works in an auto rotation, obviously we didn't come to that overnight. And that was conversations with chief engineers of different aircraft, you know, all walks of life, pilots. And we had to figure out how to give all that agency, all the capability, and then make sure the system was going to work 100% of the time for a maneuver like that. And we had to do that for everything, right? So this is the aircraft works, all systems are engaged and functional, and then, of course, every possible set of sensors or set of systems failing, and the system managing and going through basically the pilot's operating handbook in the if-then statement causal tree, you know, doing the right thing. And that's the 1.3 million lines of code that's taken a lot of time. And we did all of that in what's called a deterministic fashion. So that means for any given set of inputs, you are always going to get a consistent output. And so if we were to write that out, that's like a giant equation. There's no hallucinating in this AI. This AI, you know, is entirely provably correct and based on physics and math.
What has AI's role been in this?
Yeah, so AI now is such, you know, there's so much buzz around this, but you know, the graduate student book that I had on artificial intelligence largely has not changed over the last several years. And there's two fields of artificial intelligence, deterministic and non-deterministic. Non-deterministic is what's all the rage right now, and generative AI falls into that category. Deterministic AI is in the field of things like Bayes' law, probability of B given A. You know, if it's raining outside, what's the probability that's going to rain? And so math and statistics can actually produce what we would call intelligence. And this is what, you know, was making product recommendations in the 90s and doing printer troubleshooting. And so there's a lot of forms of deterministic artificial intelligence that feel almost like sentient, you know, intelligence, but they are not thinking on their own in the sense that they're not going to come up with something new and novel, which we believe is the only way AI in itself should be applied directly to aviation as it pertains to being in control. Because if 1% of the time, you know, the flight control system said, oh, you know, unicorn instead of zebra, like that's a really bad outcome and you shouldn't get on an airplane or a helicopter with that architecture. So that's the category of AI. And when I say deterministic, that's what I mean. That being said, you know, we recently unveiled our flight assistant called Skylar. Skylar is the first application written on top of SkyOS, our operating system. And Skylar goes a bit beyond that. Skylar is more a pilot aid. So it's going to help pilots with things like communication. So it's listening to the air traffic controller and telling the pilots what's being said and flagging if their tail number is mentioned and then recommending responses. You know, for pilot recommendations and situational awareness, that's a category where you can get a little bit away from the deterministic specific category and, you know, do things that may not 100% of the time be correct, but still provide significant aid to the pilot, and the pilot is still inserted as a decision maker about whatever is suggested by that field of AI.
Will Skylar respond? Because you and I have both been flying, and there's so much traffic, and you're trying. You know, I've missed a few calls here and there, especially coming into a major airport. They get annoyed, and they should. How does that work? Just curious. Or is it like a pop-up that says, "Hey, they just called you. Here's a response," and I can just hit my mic and read it.
Yeah, it's more the latter to start with. The FAA, so of course, as you know, every communication that's spoken is ultimately a legal document. And so the idea of a robot speaking over the radio today is not something the regulatory body is accepting of. That's probably going to change in the not too distant future. But for now, it more looks like what you're suggesting. But I think even the more, so there's a couple pieces of significant value. Number one, you'll never miss a radio call again, right? That's the aspiration. Number two, you're always going to have a fairly intelligent readback shown to you. And then number three, if there's a change to your flight plan or the altitude or the heading, that is identified to you in part of what it's captured. And all you have to do is literally press the button embedded in this log, and it automatically sends it to SkyOS, and SkyOS redirects your aircraft.
So if they tell me to go from 10 to 8,000 feet, turn left to 270, I can hit accept, and it's already in there. I don't have to twist two knobs and then hit an autopilot mode.
Correct.
Actually, twist two knobs, hit an autopilot mode, and then dial down my VSI.
Yes.
That's what I'd have to do if I was on autopilot. Some people like to hand fly.
That's right.
But let me ask you this, too. With everything you've talked about, and you guys have had some of the first automated flight milestones, significant, right? The Cirrus, the couple different Robinsons, the Black Hawk. How does this then, in all this, all the work that you've done, talk about certification and what's next steps for you there?
Yeah, we really are in the final throes of validation, verification, and four-credit flight tests now. And we have about 2,800 or so hours flying the technology to figure out how to write SkyOS and obviously make sure that all the handling qualities and its management in all of these different emergencies is well handled. So yeah, we're 10 years in. We're in this final phase. We've obviously got to go prove to ourselves and the FAA that it performs as expected. The good news is couple-fold. Number one, we never have to design and engineer any of these components again. So all the things I was listing that we are going through, the what's called DO-160 testing. So this is like hot, cold, shake, bake, salt fog types of tests. You don't have to do that again, you know, on things like a flight control computer or other component. The other is that we are pursuing and will achieve a supplemental type certificate. And this is a big point. So we're focused on retrofitting existing certified airplanes and helicopters with this technology. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of which is obviously they're flying today. There's hundreds of thousands of them. And obviously our mission statement is to make this industry safe. The best way to do that is to offer it to the existing aircraft that are already flying places. And part of what that allows us to do is instead of achieving what's called a type certificate, which is what everybody else who's designing and engineering a whole new airframe is required to do, we only need to achieve a supplemental type certificate. And the transferability of that supplemental type certificate, its artifacts, is very high from one platform to the next because, of course, the hardware is the same, and then the operating system's logic is almost unchanged, right? So, of course, the pilot's operating handbook is different from one machine to the next. We hard code that in, and then it's a matter of what we call handling quality. So this is like, you know, how the stick feels and how it performs in certain parts of the flight envelope. To your point about the Black Hawk, one of the things that we're really excited about is from receiving the Black Hawk and the first removal of a part. So we remove a tremendous amount of conventional parts from the aircraft in order to install ours, and we save a lot of weight in the process. In just 91 days from that part being first removed to flying the Black Hawk with the swipe of a finger to take off fully automated, it was just 91 days. And if you watch the video of the Black Hawk doing this, it looks like it's stationary in air. It is so dialed and so much more tuned than we would have expected out of the gate. So, you know, that video is of the first flight in the first 3 hours before we, you know, invested months or, you know, dozens of hours into further maturing it. And so I think that just shows how quickly this technology can be adapted, you know, to different airplanes and helicopters. And the last thing I'll say is the helicopter, and especially the small helicopter, is the hardest of all of the different categories of aircraft because helicopters, as we talked about, inherently unstable as compared to the airplane, which is more stable. And the power, volume, weight, every design requirement as imposed on our technology is harder in a superset of what's necessary if you go to a bigger helicopter or an airplane, small or a big airplane. And so it's actually downhill for us to apply the technology to these other aircraft.
Well, and there's a difference between assisted flight, as you're talking about. If I had this in my Cirrus, right, this would be assisted flight. But how do you feel about either fully autonomous or where the industry might be going with an airplane that's so capable there's actually not even a pilot up in the cockpit?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, at our core, as I've touched on, we are very focused on empowering pilots and empowering humans inside the aircraft. And I believe for humans on board those machines, there will always be someone in the front of the aircraft acting as the pilot. Now, what it means to be a pilot over time, I think that will evolve, and we've already seen this in the military space, right? What a military pilot is doing today is very different than what a military pilot was doing, you know, in an aircraft decades ago. That will happen in the commercial world. Are there applications where our technology can be flown unmanned and is it capable of it? Absolutely. Out of the gate, the very first thing we did was fly a full-scale helicopter, completely unmanned, no safety pilot on board. We achieved that in 3 months. That helicopter is now hanging from the ceiling in our headquarters I'm sitting in. So, you know, unmanned flight in a lot of respects is actually very easy. What is hard is building highly reliable unmanned flight and doing so in a certifiable fashion. And to our knowledge, we're the only company that has taken technology that can support unmanned flight and first applied it to human flown operations, piloted operations, which means that we're achieving, you know, that 10 to the minus ninth level of reliability with the human on board and all the safety benefits. But you can also take that same vehicle, take the human out of it, and then fly that asset completely unmanned. You couldn't do the opposite, right? So if you were to say buy a drone, you know, a Predator or whatever have you, you're never going to throw a saddle on the back and be like, giddy up, let's see what, you know, how this thing does, because it wasn't designed to fly humans. It wasn't designed to anything close to 10 to the minus ninth. And so that's a unique opportunity we have, right? We can take existing aircraft that are flown with pilots, make them safer, more effective. They can be flown with two pilots, one pilot, or even no pilots with the very same asset. And we actually believe that is the technology roadmap to the future. So if we're ever going to have business jets doing unmanned repositioning, for example, in our airspace, which would be a significant unit economic, you know, advantage to any operator who has that capability, it will be with technology that is certified to the highest levels that the engineering is capable of. And that is 10 to the minus ninth commercial airliner. And so that's part of why we've taken this approach, because we do believe that one day there will be specific use cases where there's no one on board, civilian and military, and the technology that will be allowed to do it will be reserved for this highest level of reliability.
And, that said, this whole movement around, we started out talking a little bit about advanced air mobility. We have eVTOLs, longer range VTOLs. It's going to require a lot of modernization of the airspace and coordination. As people basically can almost start taking off anywhere versus, airports. So where do you think the biggest over the next 5 years, where's the adoption curve going to be for SkyOS, you think?
Yeah, advanced air mobility is kind of a very big, it's obviously a big topic, and it covers a lot of different technologies and new approaches to things. We are very focused on getting SkyOS into the hands of people that need it most. So I mentioned emergency medical services, right? These are people that are being forced to make those very hard decisions, low visibility conditions because it's the bad weather that caused the accident to begin with. Well, they absolutely should have safety enhancing technology that unlocks IFR and even 0-0, which isn't even something that's being considered today. And our technology since 2017 has been taking off, quote unquote, 0-0, every automated pickup, every automated set down. We don't need eyeballs to see and safely take off or land. So, we want to get those types of people with this safety enhancing technology. Cal Fire, another good example. We signed a contract with them last year. Very similar, right? They're flying in some of the harshest conditions. And this is another use case where potentially that optionally piloted application is really interesting, because you can have an aircraft like a Black Hawk equipped for firefighting, fly in certain conditions and risks that maybe you wouldn't put anyone on board for, but some missions, you really want the pilot making the decision and then flying through the same user interface. At the end of the day, we have literally every single end use case in our backlog. Obviously, we're working with the U.S. Army as well. Another similar vein of complex operations, complex machines, and if we can reduce the cognitive load and increase the safety, that's going to make it better for them. And then we've already spent a bit of time talking about owner-operators. These are private pilots and people that want to use aircraft as transportation across the United States and internationally. And I think this is probably the biggest addressable market expansion opportunity, because there's no shortage of people that want to engage in aviation to fly and go places. And a couple statistics that really jump out at us: 1 out of 7 people graduates from flight school that starts. So these are the people that go to their local flight school, they want to engage with aviation. 6 out of 7 wash out. And it's not because they didn't appreciate the time that it would take, or they certainly did some of the math on how much it would cost, but they get into these cockpits and they're like, man, this feels like nothing else. This feels like World War II, brought to life for $1 million plus on the quote unquote state of the art today. And by the way, I'm one error away from killing myself and my whole family. And that's just not how we engage with anything else in the world. And so you end up with 6 out of 7 people that don't do it. But there's a lot of people that have the means to engage in aviation if it's safe and easy to fly, as is evident by the number of private boats that are far more expensive and far less useful that exist in this country and internationally. We think there's a huge opportunity there. That's more in the 5 to 10 year range. I think the near term is really the professional users that are trying to fly these very complex missions and need every tool and technology they can to increase the safety and the utility of the aircraft.
Well, I love that. And, as we wrap up, as you're looking ahead, let's just say it's, 5, 10 years out, and you're looking back and you say, you know what, we were a part of that. Here's the legacy that we created with all the work that we did. What is that legacy that you want you and your team and what you're working on now to be known for?
We want to see the safety statistics in this industry be driven as close as possible to zero. And obviously that's aspirational, but we believe we can make a significant dent in general aviation, more broadly aviation safety, and bring more pilots to the industry as well, bring more people to wanting to fly. And we believe that that is the keystone to really unlocking this industry and taking it from the scale that it is today and the hundreds of thousands of aircraft to the millions of aircraft that we believe there really is demand for as it pertains to transportation at large. And I think, what does that mean in the future? That means more opportunities in life being unlocked for people, right? Anytime there's been a new transportation technology integrated into society. Even something as simple as an application on a phone, you know, to move around taxis, in a relative sense, people consume more transportation, not less, and not just a little more, exponentially more. And so if we can make it easier and safer to fly, drive the safety statistics to a place that are far better than today, then we would be very excited and proud, you know, if decades from now you look up in the skies and, you know, your 16-year-old is flying, you know, around the same time that they're driving a car, because that is entirely possible with the technology as it exists now. There's just, you know, obviously work to do to get everything moved closer to that direction.
Well, and I could also see, you know, if it's that far out, right, the, you know, the Jetson era is going to be here. We could have a VTOL that's 4 or 5 passenger VTOL that's quiet enough to take off from my yard and can take off safely and you know, fly to work, fly to home, fly to grocery store. You never know. I think we're going to – those sound a little futuristic. I believe that's going to be what society does. It's going to look like something out of Star Wars. I believe that.
I do too. My only hesitation is the taking off and landing places. I think we'll probably still have, you know, corners of streets or something like that. Because if everybody was going in their backyard, I suspect people will be a little bit less accepting of that. But
I think my HOA would be very upset. But me, I'd have to live out in the country a little bit more. But yeah,
so 100%.
Mark, with that, I'd love to have you back on. And you know what? If you guys are ever doing any testing or you have a big milestone coming up, you know, let us know. We'd love to come out, be there on site, film you guys, you know, push it out to our whole audience. Our audience would absolutely love that and share it all over the world. So love to stay in touch and hope to get to meet you in person here someday soon.
I look forward to it, John. Yeah. No, enjoyed the conversation. Yeah, I look forward to making all that happen.
All right. Keep knocking them alive, brother.
Thank you. Appreciate it.